episode 652 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and this has not been a good year for isolation rooms.
No, I suppose not. It's also not been a very good year for Heroes Reborn. We already know it's canceled, guys. We're not jumping
either canceled or just finishing its limited run that they intended all along. Whichever spin you want to put on it.
That's a good point. I'll just leave that alone. But before we go into the episodic discussion, Edmund, why don't you give a disclaimer?
Absolutely. We will talk about anything that might have happened in these episodes. So if you haven't seen them, you'll be spoiled.
Yes, indeed. And, we had a bit more content this particular week. We're still just going to keep it to a top two and a bottom two. But, this is the beginning of the ramp up. Starting next time, we're going to have a lot more to discuss, and it's just going to keep piling on. So, yeah, we're glad that there are a couple shows that are getting close to the end of their run so that we can clear the decks a little bit. And also, though, we have some good shows coming back that we have been looking forward to for quite some time. And the new show premiering. It's just a mix. Bag.
Oh, yes.
But we're going to go ahead and start at the with our bottom two as usual. And Edmund, the first one is one you're going to have to carry here.
This is the latest episode of Elementary, season 4, episode 8, A Burden of Blood. And if the mouse will cooperate, there we go. Holmes and Watson investigate a homicide in which the victim was murdered in a manner reminiscent of crimes committed by an infamous and already incarcerated serial killer. Meanwhile, Bell gets tutored by Sherlock and Joan for a police sergeant's exam that could lead to a promotion and a post at another precinct. And I gave this what has become my standard 7. It is in that straight average category. The actual case they're working on... once again, as I was mentioning in our news show, with Elementary, it's very much straight procedural at this point. The police work has a couple of little twists to it, but really not much. And the show is sustained on the interactions of those main characters and the behind the scenes stuff. This is also a case where they actually slipped into one of those most hideous of TV tropes where of the guest stars who we have appearing who might be potential killers, guess what? It's Noah Bean, the most famous one, who is in fact the one who did it. So, it was one of those classic cases. He shows up at halfway through, and it's like, guess what? I wonder where he's going to be at the end of the episode. And sure enough, once again, case not really worthy of Sherlock Holmes, but Johnny Lee Miller and Lucy Liu and Detective Bell I can't remember the name of the actor, but Aidan Quinn do wonderful work creating characters that we care about, even if the cases themselves aren't really that compelling.
Hmm. Yeah, that's unfortunate. It just seems like that show is definitely kind of hitting a bit of a rough patch. Of late. Would that be a good way of putting it?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't even necessarily call it a rough patch. It's just that they've just hit this straight formulaic mode where it really does feel like it's just another of the CBS procedurals, and just can't really get out of that, or isn't allowed to get out of that storytelling rut.
Hmm. Yeah, that's unfortunate. Speaking of a storytelling rut, I think we already kind of alluded to this, but this unfortunate. I have to say that I am disappointed that the show is coming to such an inauspicious end here. I had a little bit of hope that the revival would go somewhere, and it started off okay. But Heroes Reborn is once again at the bottom of our list. Season 5, Episode 12, Company Woman. Erica Kravitz's past surfaces as the end of civilization approaches. Meanwhile, Melina scrambles to unite with Tommy and is joined by Luke as Quentin and Phoebe plot against them, and Matt Parkman tries to ensure his family's safety, jeopardizing Taylor's life in the process. This episode came in at an average of 5.75, which definitely is at the bottom of our list for sure. And I just have to say that I was rereading this description and didn't remember half of what I just read being in the episode. It probably was.
Yeah, no, I just wasn't that
invested in it.
It was just this whole series of sort of set piece conflicts, and certainly, you know, and titling it Company Woman, of course, a little reference back to season one and Company Man, the episode that finally gave us the background on Noah and Noah Bennett, and but in this case, they had turned her into such a sort of, I mean, she's not twirling a mustache, but you might as well be, you know, mustache twirling villain, that this attempt to sort of invest her with some humanity was just sort of clumsily done, and I've already reached the point where I just did not care enough about the character to sort of have the OMG moment that that I think they were trying for. With the rest of it, it really was just this whole series of conflicts and people facing off against each other, and just for the sake of people waving guns at each other, as near as I could tell, and then leading to this this supposedly big revelation at the end, where Tommy's wound up in the same sort of cyber prison that Hero was, but at this point, just seeing that clumsy VR world come clunking down just kind of elicited groans rather than any great sense of danger.
It's just, yeah, like you said, they invoke the title of one of the best episodes of the first season in this incredibly mediocre callback. It just really highlights everything that was wrong with the episode. It's like, so you compared yourself to one of the best episodes of the series, and you have nothing to really show for it.
No.
Yeah.
And this this is the penultimate episode leading into their grand finale, such as it is.
Yes, the grand finale.
Yeah,
there's been news that they want to just somehow keep it going in some way, shape, or form still, really? After crashing and burning. Anyway,
I was amused to see though that the guide on my DVR is still up to scratch, because what it had been calling the season finale, which just aired, we will talk about it next week, had in fact been updated to series finale.
Mm-hmm.
So my DVR anyway, I think, has the right idea.
All right. Well, that means that we can move on up to the top two of the week, and this is in stark contrast, of course, and it's some familiar faces.
Yes.
Yes, indeed. And we're going to start off here with Jessica Jones, Season 1, Episode 9, a.k.a. Sinbin. Jessica backs Kilgrave into a corner, but Hogarth complicates the situation. Also, details about Kilgrave's past surface.
Yes.
And this episode got an 8.5. Lots of scores this time coming in, including one from VogNetwork.com, our friend Flacco Jones over there, giving this one a 7.5 and said, "Things went from nuts to just crazy in this episode. At times I felt the roles were reversed, where Jessica was the lunatic and Kilgrave was the victim." That was kind of the intent. Yes. Anyway, like you said, the only thing I didn't really like in this episode is that Kilgrave's parents just happened to be in New York and easy to find during this episode. I like the idea of them hiding out in the support group, but just seemed far too convenient. And I'll admit that was one of the reasons that I only give this one an 8.5. I didn't take off nearly as much, but it was probably the weakest point of the entire episode for me. But you seem to have not minded too much on this one, Edmund.
No. Well, I mean, I think it was more the way they did such a good job of setting up Jessica appearing to be over the top and Kilgrave just playing the victim so well, playing with that whole concept of, here they are trying to get him to reveal himself, and he is just doing his level best to turn the tables. I was also just on a strictly personal note, I may have been joking about the European Soccer Championships last episode, but I actually am quite a big British football fan, and I've got some friends who are are big rugby fans who keep trying to get me into rugby. And since I haven't, that's why I completely did not get the other meaning of the title, where it's a rugby term that actually Jessica uses to help track down those parents in Manchester. But of course, I mean, talking about the title of Heroes Reborn, where they were invoking, badly invoking that past success. But here, I mean, I did love the use of, I mean, of Sin been standing as much for that, you know, that isolation room where they've been keeping Kilgrave, and sort of all of the various sins and transgressions that from both the past and what for most of the episode we're thinking what might happen in the present, and then of course, you know, horrifically badly, you know, everything of course goes wrong at the end. I mean, just as it did at the end of the previous episode, but in an even more extreme form. The way they set up that whole sense of is she going too far, at least for Hogarth and Clark Peters as the cop, you know, the people who she needs to convince of who Kilgrave actually is, the way that the way she's coming off, I just thought was just marvelously done, but then of course to have it all explode at the end, so that the cop does know exactly what getting Kilgrave is like, can't necessarily do anything about it.
Yeah, it's there. Every so often, they do try to make him sympathetic, and then he orders his mother to stab herself repeatedly,
yes,
and things of that nature. The end of this episode was just brutal, and yeah. I don't know if enjoyed it was the word that I would use, but mm-hmm. I appreciated the brutality and the honesty of it, because yes, this is exactly the way that this whole situation should implode. Yes. At least
but it was also the way they built up to it in terms of when Hogarth almost let him out, and you knew the moment, yes, you know, the moment he got out, it was, everything was going to blow up, and you know, and then but then it gets postponed just that crucial amount of time. And even just the little touches, like, you know, or ordering Trish to shoot herself, and you know, but she's out of bullets, and just that look as she has to do it, and it was just horrific.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. I mean, this is just this series is an amazing piece of work, to say the least. And yeah, we're getting close. I guess this is roughly around the final turn for the season, as we kind of rush towards resolution here, mm-hmm. With the last few episodes. So yeah, this was important information. Like I said, just that introduction of the parents was a little clunky as far as I was concerned, but not necessarily a showstopper.
Yeah. Yeah. And
at the top of the list.
Yeah. And also, I mean, even though I haven't been, I think the performance hasn't been that solid, certainly compared to the main characters, but that little introduction of Simpson's nefarious, you know, not nefarious, but clandestine, origins, and the doctor coming in and the talk of the reds and the blues and the whites, and was some interesting little details that presumably is setting stuff up for later on or down the line or whenever, but just as some of that little Marvel University stuff that certainly looks like it could have some interesting ramifications.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but are you familiar with that classic Daredevil saga that this may be kind of referencing?
I have not read it, but I've heard tell of it. So
yes, indeed. I'm wondering then if it's going to play into Jessica Jones or if it's going to be seeding something for the future. Not sure, but we'll find out soon enough, I suppose. All right. Now, Jessica Jones was 3 weeks in a row, and maybe even further back. I didn't remember, but at least 3 weeks in a row was our number one show for the week. And now it's number two. But technically, it is still at the top slot, because number one and number two shows both came in at an 8.5. So for those who were wondering, oh, did they get edged out? Jessica Jones, not quite. It's just a tie. And the other show in a tie with it is, of course, the season premiere of Agent Carter, two-part episode, season two episodes one and two, The Lady in the Lake and A View in the Dark. After moving to Los Angeles to aid the West Coast branch of SSR, Peggy investigates a strange death in which the body glows and emanates cold. Indeed. And like I said, this came in at an average of 8.5. Now, I was kind of hoping that Gary was here for this, but unfortunately he's otherwise engaged. But Edmund, what were your thoughts about this premiere?
I enjoyed it quite a bit. Yeah, I mean, score-wise, me and Gary were the two slightly lower at eights. I know Gary had been making noises about not really liking the move to Los Angeles. I'm not exactly sure why, and we'll have to catch up with him when we can to get more details there. But for me, there was something felt slightly disjointed. I personally didn't mind the shift, and was certainly enjoying seeing seeing Peggy back and Jarvis. And I really like the fact that yes, Jarvis's wife has now made her wonderfully flamboyant appearance. Perhaps not, you know, and certainly is a wonderful foil for the far more very British Peggy and Jarvis to play off of. Something about the beats, and maybe this was intentional, of her having the sort of on and off flirtation with the scientist, the whole sort of triangle that they're setting up at the office. But it was something where I was sort of feeling this throughout the episode, and I can't quite put my finger on it, but it was just the story itself seemed to be jumping around so much it was hard for me to sort of, you know, I wasn't feeling, you know, sort of a lot of narrative flow. They were just sort of hitting all these points, and it wasn't quite feeling as cohesive as last season felt.
Mm. Yeah, I think that Henry in his review over at VogNetwork.com said a lot of the same stuff. He specifically keyed into the fact that you had the whole Dottie mystery that was still kind of being referenced, and then it disappears, it seems, completely with the move to LA and everything else. So it's almost like, why bring all that up if you're not going to be following through with it? And he kind of leaves it out there that maybe it will be followed up, but it doesn't really... It doesn't quite gel. And I get the feeling, too. I watched the two episodes, of course, on the night of the premiere, and I also felt kind of coming out of it like, what exactly, where is this going? It didn't have what's the word that I want to use here? But the first season had maybe a little bit of novelty, because we didn't expect that it was going to happen. And then when it did, it was really cool that we got that opportunity to have that series. And now maybe it's, you know, it's returning. What are the expectations? It's just it's probably a lot of little things on my end that are adding up to feeling like it's a little bit less than what it was last time. But still, it came in at an 8.5. Yeah. It's hardly in Heroes Reborn territory, that's for sure.
Yeah, and it wasn't that I wasn't finding it enjoyable. It was just something was feeling off, and I wish I could be more specific about it. But it was. And I think there was, I think it was partially, it was that sort of fish out of water feeling about it, where even though that was certainly, you know, one of the major elements of the first season, and but it did feel more focused in terms of, you know, no, this is Peggy having to put up with being the woman in a man's world and all of that that sort of over the top sexism that they were giving us at the beginning, where it almost became a camp motif that they then pulled back on as the characters became more well rounded and more human, basically, as you actually got to know them, so there was, and certainly with the whole sort of not quite mad scientist, although it seemed pretty close towards the end of the episode there, the second episode, getting into more of that shield territory of strange possibly alien devices and things, and certainly this whole mystery of the frozen lake and body, so they may have been trying to get that sort of that sense of dislocation, but it didn't necessarily really help the story and things getting started. But then again, I mean, as I was talking it through and remembering how some of the things that we found a little off-putting at the beginning of season one and how that came together, I can just hope that it's just a case of the same thing where they're setting it up a certain way and think things will improve as it goes along.
Mm-hmm. All good points, all good points. And I think, unfortunately or fortunately, we only have a short run here. So I guess we'll find out what it looks like when we get to the end. Very shortly.
Indeed, yes.
Yes. All right, well, the show that normally has been in the top with Jessica Jones was unfortunately just edged out because of the return of Agent Carter. And that show would be The Expanse, Season 1, Episode 7, Windmills. Holden and crew come to realize that they're not alone on the Rocinante and end up facing a Martian marine blockade. At his bleakest point, Miller finds a new reason to keep going. And Avisarala visits Holden's family in Montana. I can do Rocinante, but I can't do that. Too many A's.
You just like tilting at those windmills. I know.
I do, believe me. This one coming in at an average of 8.33. And I think that it was yet another solid entry for The Expanse.
Yeah, this, that whole setup on the Rocinante of finding the stowaway, trying to run the blockade, and certainly I was just realizing I really should have looked it up, but that whole thing of trying to find magic code words and break into the security locker, and then once they finally got them, and it was, you know, those of us who have ever had to take the SAT, what they call SAT words, basically, that you intone those, and magically you are you are sent on your way. Some very nice tension built up, and a very nice sort of classic case of, you know, okay, he's a spy, he's our captive, we really don't want to trust him, but then again, he really doesn't want to get caught either. So enemy of my enemy is my friend, at least for now. So I thought that was quite nicely done, and certainly with the visit to Holden's family, giving us that little bit of again a case of where they were letting the audience catch up, or just giving enough of the details of the fact that, you know, yes, this is a future society where group marriages are more of an accepted thing, and a nice little casting coup getting Frances Fisher to come in for to play Holden's mother, I really like the way they've been primarily following the story of the first book, but as I mentioned, Avisarala is really a character from the second book, they've made very good use of her to fill in some of that background, which I wouldn't say you didn't get it in the first book, but if you got it, it was more, of course, in terms of knowing what's going on in characters' heads, which is a lot harder to do in TV than in the books. Nice combination of pushing the plot along and also filling in some of that background for us as well, without hitting us over the head with, you know, yes, there's odd polygamous pairings going on. It's just the way some people live.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, just a lot of interesting ideas that The Expanse is dealing with in this first season, and I'm enjoying the fact that it's doing so in unapologetically, which is basically what we just did a great job of explaining why that's the case. But I'm just really kind of impressed that this is a show that Sci-Fi brought out. Think about it, you know, a couple of years ago, if we heard about this, we would have maybe thought, is it even going to happen?
Yeah.
And yet here we are, where we have a really hard science fiction television show just nailing it, and Sci-Fi is the one that's putting it out there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can't complain too much.
Oh yeah, no, I mean, I'm also very thankful that this was a case of having read the first book when those first trailers first started coming out, and looking at the trailers and going like, this is one of those rare cases of where what I was picturing in my head is showing up on screen there, and just crossing my fingers that it was going to live up to it. It wasn't just the case of that classic case of they can make great trailers out of little snippets from here and there, in Hollywood, but this is definitely a case of the trailer reflecting the finished product, and looking forward to them keeping going, and certainly they've got plenty of material, so just keeping my fingers crossed that there is enough interest, and they're able to keep going for at least the standard sci-fi 4 to 5 seasons.
Yeah, who knows what it's actually going to turn out to be. Yeah, would it? I guess because they stealth gave Haven a stealthy sixth season without calling it one.
Yes.
It doesn't count. So yeah, we got to find a way for them to have a dramatic series that makes it past 5 seasons. All right, next on the list is The Flash, Season 2, Episode 10, Potential Energy. Barry considers telling Patty that he is The Flash. Meanwhile, Joe and Iris try to get to know Wally, and the team hunts down a metahuman who can slow time itself. And this came in at an average of 8.2. And Nadim coming in at a 7, saying, ooh, while still entertaining from start to finish, the Barry-Patty drama was too contrived and frustrating in this mediocre mid-season premiere. And that's actually a lot of what Henry was saying in his comments as well. Gary, of course, liked it quite a bit more, but unfortunately he can't speak to that. But Edmund, how about you?
I will not necessarily argue that yes, that whole resolution of the Patty drama was a little contrived. The classic, I've taken a job elsewhere, so I'm shuffling off screen, but of course could still come back at some point. But that aside, I actually rather liked the way they were addressing one of the long time ongoing conflicts of do you tell, do you not tell, and interesting having them go this route in this DCW universe where if anything, especially over on Arrow, it's been more the case of no, this is getting silly, all these people need to know. and we had some of the same thing going on with The Flash as well, and certainly having having our resident villain, or at least not particularly nice prickly guy now, Harry, being the one to warn him off, and basically telling him that he really shouldn't tell her, given all his nightmares about Zoom really will come true. I thought they laid it out rather nicely, and I certainly I did enjoy Aaron Douglas's guest turn as the turtle. I think it was a perfect case of casting, certainly, with his physical presence and sort of stolidness matching the character very well, I do enjoy his work, I can see where criticism could come from. It just didn't bother me as much.
Yeah, and I gave it an 8.5 as well, so I didn't quite feel that tension either. I can understand them coming with the show coming back, some of the folks out there wanting it to come back with a bang as far as these, an action-packed plot and so forth. But the show is also carried well by the characters and their relationships, and I think sometimes we tend to forget that. But The Flash being the more lighthearted of the two shows, yeah, it makes sense for them to focus on this. I understand, the whole thing with Patty was a little bit cliche, but it's a comic book show. Of course it's going to be cliche. It kind of wears them on its sleeve. But there we are. Speaking of a show that, again, is superhero in nature and wearing things on their sleeve a little bit, is Supergirl, Season 1, Episode 10, Childish Things. Kara does her best to support Wynn and keep him safe when his father, the evil toy man, breaks out of prison. Kat offers Lucy a job at Catco, and Alex asks Hank to use his powers to help uncover Maxwell Lord's plans. And this one coming in at an average of 8.17, so just a hair below The Flash. And, one of the things that, I gave it an 8, so I certainly didn't give it a bad score, but one of the things that kind of threw me off a little bit, and I probably took off half a point just for this, was the whole idea of of Wynn coming along and saying, with all intent purposes, well, because I need you to be with me because I might turn evil if you're not.
Yeah.
I know that's not what he said, but it was implied by his choice of wording. And I was going, really? Well, certainly she's going to stay with you then. It's not like she's got a whole, you know, array of superpowers to deal with that whole villainy problem that you apparently are going to have. But really? Come on, guys. What were your thoughts on this one, Edmund?
I also just found it a little bit odd that the sort of getting sprung seemingly out of the blue of, you know, oh yes, by the way, I'm the son of this crazed villain who's been locked up all this time. Especially, you know, it's one of those classic cases where, you know, yes, I know they're not at the Daily Planet, it's Catco, but still there seems to be, you know, quite a lot of, you know, investigative journalism type stuff going on around there, and people digging into things certainly and trying to find things out about people. That was part of the contrivance for me. It does seem to be a bit of a common thread through it's not the DCW, they're officially not sharing universes, but of all these Berlanti produced shows they have the in the first seasons they have these personal relationships and that just seem to be awkwardly done, and this seems to be Supergirls and certainly the whole trope of, you know, it's, you know, it's being of sort of being friend zoned and everyone around saying, oh yes, well, I can, you know, I can see how much you feel for it, etc. Hasn't been as well done as some of the other stuff, and certainly, you know, I'm thinking specifically in terms of the way they've developed Cat Grant's character and sort of turned her from, you know, no, it's not just a TV version of the Devil Wears Prada, and giving her a little more depth and interest, harpyish mother aside. So yeah, there's been some issues there too, but. Yeah, it's just with all of these shows, you know, they usually manage to work it out as the seasons go along, but early on, some of the personal relationship stuff can just be a little too awkward and slightly embarrassing at times.
It's. I don't know if maybe there's a part of me too that almost feels like maybe they did it intentionally. They kind of went there in order to kind of expose some of those kinds of thought processes, like you said, the infamous friend zone kind of attitude that some people get into. It's so immature at the first place, but it's like you could see a show like Supergirl being the one that would address it almost in the most kind of like, yeah, guy, go ahead, throw that out there, and everyone's going to talk about how ridiculous it was, and some of them are going to see it for what it is, and some of them are going to think, wow, really, you went there? And not see that maybe or at least that there was the potential for it to have been intentionally done that way. Mm-hmm. But I do feel like they do a really nice job of lacing in some of these, what I guess some people would kind of pejoratively put as feminist ideas. I just think it's more just smart and necessary social discussion into this show, because it's been there kind of from the beginning. And they do kind of they do attack some of those tropes with Kara and Kat mm-hmm. in a lot of respects as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So just because they don't put a huge, you know, lampshade on it or something doesn't mean that they're not doing it intentionally. So just a thought that was kind of going through my mind. All right. Next on the list is a completely different kind of show.
Yes.
The Man in the High Castle, Season 1, Episode 9, Kindness. Frank must risk his life to help Joe. Meanwhile, Smith finally learns who is responsible for the assassination attempt. Tagami is distressed when he discovers the ramifications of his scheming, and Kido's investigation takes a climactic turn. Yes, it's supposed to be climactic, but it says climatic turn. I don't think it means that the weather changes.
No.
But okay. Climactic turn, guys. Come on, write it correctly.
So far as we know, no, the Nazis haven't figured out how to way to control the weather yet.
That's right. They haven't gotten the plans of Nikola Tesla's secret machine or anything like that. Yes. For those who are into the HARP conspiracy theory lore. Anyway, where that came from, I'm not sure. At any rate, this one coming in at an average of 8, and certainly, again, this show is knocking it out of the park. And this episode, in particular, I was really intrigued by that film that they showed at the end, mm-hmm. which kind of threw me for a loop because I wasn't sure what to really do with that. I don't remember that being part of the equation in the novel. So
at this point, I mean, just the fact that they were making it a film in the first place, not a book, was already a departure. But then this whole concept of the second film and the characters from the show from this alternate reality showing up in the film was certainly a twist where it definitely appears to be pushing things into a more fantastical, could we say more fringy sort of environment, and certainly introducing the possibility, you know, some strange crossovers and alternate realities and things, far more so than the book did, so at this point I would definitely say this is far more an inspired by rather than a based on, the way they have shifted Joe's character, where he was since they've now diverged this much, I mean, I'll say he was basically a straight up villain in the book. He is using her to get to the man in the high castle to assassinate him, basically. None of which is happening in the show. In fact, he even goes through a transformation at the end of the book where he washes out his dye and appears in full blonde Aryan splendor, or in his mind anyway. some very interesting twists that they're taking, I will be quite intrigued to see where they wind up with this in that next final episode.
Yes, and of course, knowing that they're coming back for a second season, it's intriguing to think where they're going to end this first season. That's for sure.
Yes, indeed.
All right, let's see then. Moving on from there to The Good Wife, Season 7, Episode 12, Tracks. Alicia and Carrie join forces to defend a former client who is facing a multi-million-dollar lawsuit over ownership rights to his new music. Meanwhile, Alicia's neighbors threaten her with eviction for operating her firm out of her apartment. And Nadine gave this one an 8, saying, not the greatest episode from a narrative perspective, but Tracks definitely had some great character moments interspersed throughout. And this one came in at an 8. And finally, we have a new show here called Colony, Season 1, Episode 1, Pilot. Really? Come on.
And no, it's not because he flies a plane.
No. The premiere of the futuristic drama about an alien-occupied L.A. First up, Will Sullivan attempts a daring rescue while Kitty, his wife, tries to help a relative in need. In other events, a job opportunity threatens to divide the family.
Or in completely related events. Oh, sorry.
Yes, completely related events. This one coming in at an average of 7.33, which is not particularly bad for the first episode of a series. I have to say that this was fairly average, which, again, not too bad for a first episode. There's a lot to introduce. It's clear that they intended to sidestep the whole what's going on with this invasion question mm-hmm. completely.
Yes.
Which is fine. It was just a little bit on the nose that the husband and wife, and again, I need to go back to this, Will and Katie, yep. would end up kind of diametrically opposed.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little obvious that that's where it would go. I'm hoping that turns out to be a little more complex. But anyway, your thoughts on this one?
Yeah, I mean, certainly a lot of the setup is some. I mean, I was going to say conventional in for those of us who know science fiction backwards and forwards. But this whole idea of alien occupation. So you've got bits and pieces of V or Falling Skies, even Alien Nation, maybe to a little bit of an extent. end, except, of course, you know, as you said, all the alien parts or possibly alien parts are all being kept off screen. I mean, there was certainly, you know, it's a lot of it felt very familiar. Some of the things I did like was in terms of those family dynamics and the sort of tension within the family, I found much more realistic than Falling Skies in particular. It was reminded me of as an extreme contrast, where you know, it was the mighty Mason family against the world, and you know, and never a bad word said between them, so that was refreshing to see, and also the in terms of playing out how the tension in this sort of situation does spill over into your personal relations, and so that part I liked. Peter Jacobson showing up as seeming like an absolute carbon copy of his Taub character from House, and it just sort of felt like, yes, if Taub was in an alien invasion, this is where he would wind up. You know, so yes, it did seem a little bit too cliched, sort of classic, collaborator, Quisling, governor. Yeah, it sort of, you know, yeah, they didn't shoot themselves in the foot, but it also wasn't necessarily hugely compelling yet.
No, and I guess that makes sense because I wouldn't expect it yet anyway, but considering that Carlton Cuse is pretty well known for not just Lost, of course, having a massively well-received premiere, but just the fact that some of the AMC show or A&E shows rather that he's been involved with have been pretty well received right from the start. So it's kind of odd that he would have this show and it kind of come out of the gate a little soft. But we'll see. We'll see. The premise is interesting, and I know that both he and Josh Holloway were really excited to work together again on something like this. So I'm hoping that it picks up, but I think, like I said, for me, it was just too on the nose,
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's all that we have to discuss for this particular week's episodic discussion. When we come back next time, we're going to get into some more feedback and some open topics. So until next time.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus, under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time. Watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.